One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Well, going to university, it's something which many people would say you don't have to. I mean, look at Bill Gates. He dropped out and he did okay. And there are a whole stack of other tales of why going to university is perhaps not the the best route for everybody. However, what about if you are considering going to university and with a cost of living crisis, with all sorts of other issues coming to the fore? How do you actually cope with squaring that particular circle? And with a recent survey from the Open University saying that nearly one in two school leavers in England have reconsidered going to university as the cost of living crisis soars. Now, we're delighted to welcome, to talk about this, an ace individual, a financial guru extraordinaire. It's Iona Bain. How are you, Iona?
I'm very well. Thank you, Alex.
Now, first off, did you go to university?
I did, yes. I studied music.
Yep. Yeah, well, that, and that's why you became a financial genius.
Again, indeed, just, yes. I bet you weren't expecting that.
it just shows that classic line that it's not the degree, it's what you do with the degree. University is not so much a rite of passage, but it's a way of actually really taking time, hopefully, or ideally should be, to again figure out where your life path is. But is that becoming less affordable for our current generation?
Oh, it's such a good question, Alex. So this new research from the OU shows that half of 18 to 19 year olds in England have reconsidered going to university in the last year due to rising living costs. And what's really sad is that nearly a third of school leavers now believe university is not affordable, and a fifth are still unsure if they'll go to university this autumn as a result of this whole cost of living crisis, which is a really sad state of affairs because nobody should be, you know, giving up on education because they can't afford it. So what's really encouraging and heartening is that actually the Centre for Economic and Business Research has found if students opted for remote learning instead, they could save up to £6,555 a year. And that's because they would be accumulating less debt. They'd be able to save on their day-to-day living costs. For example, you know, they'd be living at home and that way they wouldn't be paying for accommodation, and they'd be able to earn whilst they learn, so they could get that experience out there in the jobs market and build up their financial resilience. And for so many students today who might think that university is otherwise unaffordable, this could be a real win-win.
It's also a win-win for the Open University as well, of course. Distance learning was something I think most people thought, well, that was just for the pandemic, wasn't it? But that is a viable alternative to actually, if you are considering, again, saving the pennies, etc., ensuring that you do have the value of an education, but not necessarily with all of the other costs that are associated with going to university. And we know about the £9,000 debt and the fact that universities are saying that's too small, we need to increase that, etc., etc. All of those factors lead into the notion of educational debt, really, which understandably, presumably 18 and 19-year-olds are a little less keen to award themselves with.
Yes, completely. Since I started my blog in 2011, I've seen a real shift in how young people perceive the value of university education. And the tuition fee debt that you mentioned, it can be a real psychological burden. Yes, you only have to start paying that back once you're earning above a certain amount and it gets written off at a certain point anyway. But nonetheless, I think that young people, you know, feel those sums very keenly. But also, let's not forget that actually going to a physical university, you know, staying in accommodation away from home, all of that also is very expensive. And the maintenance loan that you get each term, I'm discovering more and more, is not covering students' basic day-to-day living costs. And so that's why they are really actively considering these other options. And you mentioned before about, you know, flexible learning, the fact that the COVID pandemic really forced students to get to grips with flexible learning. I think the advantage of, you know, going to the Open University, say, is that you are making an active choice to do that. One of the problems during lockdown is that students were kind of forced into remote learning, but they were on campus. You know, they were, you know, sometimes in conditions that were far from ideal. They were not able to socialize with other students, you know, and yet they were paying for what they thought should be the full university experience. They weren't getting that. And so I think students have decided that actually, you know, if they can have their education on their own terms, if they can, you know, go out and get a job, if they can live at home, if they can build up some savings, and if they can still enjoy a really rich social life, you know, the OU does offer a huge range of societies that you can join, from gardening to gaming. You know, you can really get the best of all worlds. And I think that's what the younger generation are cottoning onto now. They're very smart and switched on.
Back in the pre-pandemic days of 2015, I was talking to colleagues over in the United States sector, and there were certain universities there who were already looking to ensure that the buildings of the university were very much going to be designed for social activities. And again, an awful lot of online learning was going to take place. To a certain extent, that's been echoed by a number of universities in Britain as well. Do you think that's the shape of the future, Iona? Do you think that it's a case of, you know, you those traditional brick university courses, and we're not talking about red brick universities here, obviously, but the standard place where you go to effectively maintain your independence or exercise your independence and head off from wherever in the country you actually happen to be. Do you think that's going to be changing and people will be adjusting their things accordingly, so they have a kind of hybrid approach to higher education?
It's a really fascinating question, Alex. You know, when I started my blog in the early days in the 2010s, I was writing quite a lot about the rise of online learning, particularly in the US, as you say there. You know, I think US online learning has taken off, you know, way more than it did in the UK. That was, of course, up until the COVID lockdown. And I think since then, you know, more and more young people are considering, you know, these options and are realizing that they're not having to give up on, you know, having a good university education, having a really great social experience. And also they're not having to give up on their career prospects either. You know, that more OU alumni actually credit their career progression or pay rise to the OU than other UK graduates do to their relevant higher education institutions. And a report from Forward Roll in 2019 found that the OU produces more CEOs and MDs than any other UK university, and that includes the likes of Oxbridge. So it just goes to show, if you want to kind of get on in the world, you know, and be a success story, then you can absolutely do that through the OU.
Well, the classic case of employability, graduate opportunities, and more, really. I do like the concept of online earning versus online learning. Which could be an interesting line we could actually take and spend an awful lot of time on. But Iona, how can people actually find out more details about the Open University? Is it as simple as I suspect it is, as typing in Open University to your search engine and taking it from there?
Yeah, you can absolutely do that. Or you can visit open.ac.uk. And if you want to apply, it's not too late. The registration deadline is the 7th of September.
And inevitably, for people who wish to find out more about your fantastic blogs and so on, Iona, how can they follow your good self?
Well, they can find me blogging at Young Money Blog, although these days it's called Youngish Money Blog. And I'm on Twitter at Iona Young Money, and I'm on Instagram at Iona J Bain.
Iona, always a delight. Iona Bain's personal finance expert extraordinaire. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And what musical instrument do you specialise in, Iona?
I play cello and piano, and I sing and I do all sorts. I'm a bit like Leo Sayer's one-man band.
But much better, I'm sure, from that point of view. That's, you know, I can't even remember. You're far too young to even remember.
I know, that's such an old school reference I've brought in there.
Yeah, very much so. We say the show must go on and all sorts of other bits and pieces.
Indeed.
Thunder in the heart. Iona Bain, take care, keep on keeping on, and keep on writing your money blogs.
I will do. Thank you, Alex.
69 hours. A long period of time, you might well say, but actually it's not so long if you bear in mind the notion of caveat emptor, buyer beware. 2 days and 21 hours, or 69 hours, that's the actual time, apparently, we need to effectively wait before making a purchase. Avoid those impulse purchases. How is this being calculated? Well, surely you've got to trust West Ham United supporter and mathematician extraordinaire Bobby Seagull. How are you, Bobby?
I'm really good, Alex. Thank you.
And congratulations on your European triumph, of course. We haven't had a chance to speak since you picked up that trophy, or the Hammers did. So well done there.
Oh, thank you. I'm a happy hammer. Even happy hammer today because I'm helping people with Vanquist make better spending decisions. So a very happy hammer.
A seamless link. So first of all, before we actually move on to find out a little bit more about Vanquist and their offerings in this field, how did you come up with 2 days and 21 hours? What is the mathematics behind that?
So with Vanquist, we commissioned research surveying adults about their purchasing decisions and their spending behaviors. And what we found was there was a tipping point at 2 days and 21 hours where people are less likely to make a regret about purchasing something. So that was almost like the optimal point. And that's a number that we'd love people to have a think about, whether they, I guess Fiona might put a post-it saying 2 days and 21 hours, or you got that mental note. We think that's the point that people should wait.
Well, you mentioned, of course, Fiona. We're delighted to welcome Fiona Anderson, Managing Director of Cards at Vanquist. How are you, Fiona?
I'm great, Alex. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Always a delight. Now, this finding that UK adults make 7 impulse purchases of at least £150 each year, which totals over £1,000, obviously £1,050, and then suffer regret, buyer's remorse, regret buying bikes, consoles, gadgets, clothes. I mean, one of the things about the internet, of course, and the web is it's so easy to just click here, click there, and suddenly you've purchased it without realising you were doing it, perhaps.
Absolutely. And it's even harder on our younger generation. So Gen Z, not my generation, but they tend to make double the amount of impulse purchases. And it's potentially the exposure to the social media that encourages it. Certainly, I get bombarded with anything I happen to have Googled. My own daughter is after a virtual reality headset, and I'm encouraging her to really think through, take the time, even longer than the 2 days and 21 hours, to think about how often she's going to use that. Because it's quite tough, because we're in the cost of living and people want to treat themselves. What we're trying to do is just help that happen in a more mindful way.
Bobby, you're a national numeracy advisor. You're obviously, we've spoken in the past about the importance of financial literacy and education in terms of that side of things. Do you think that actually having something like this, just taking time to hold back, step away from the keyboards, step away from the purchase button, shall we say, will actually help in terms of the whole system? Or is it a case of we need to go back even further?
So I think obviously having good numeracy does help you make, I think, better spending decisions. Because obviously, we're humans, we have those impulses. But again, like, for example, as a mathematician, I was really excited to work with Vanquist on that formula, sort of that cost per use. So again, in lockdown, one thing that I purchased was with my cousin, lockdown, we're thinking, oh, we've got lots of time. We bought a games console for about £500. We thought, oh, cool, that sounds fine. We're going to use it loads of times. And it turned out that we only used it 5 times in that year. So a simple cost per use is 500 divided by the 5. It's £100 per use. And again, people can apply it on the website themselves for their own items. But it's getting people to take a step back and rather than just relying on their gut instinct and impulse, say, actually, should I wait a little bit? Again, that 2 days and 21 hours. And then actually, can I work out a cost per use for this item? So the more people, I think, are, again, mindful or considerate about their decisions, I think they're less likely they are to make a sort of regretful decision.
Fiona, it would seem that we're in a constant battle between the sellers, the buyers, that kind of psychology that works in terms of making the purchase actually happen. I mean, what are the basic psychologies that sellers often employ to effectively say, OK, come on, come on, come on, press that button, you can do it, etc.? Because it can be very tempting.
It can. And it's tough for businesses. It's tough for customers, isn't it? Everyone's trying to encourage lots of the behaviours that perhaps help those retail businesses. And I'm a shopper. I absolutely love shopping. So anyone who can hear me now will absolutely attest to that. But it's helping people have a few tools in the kit to make sure that they've got that. Bobby mentioned my old school post-it note. It's a few things that maybe just interrupt the excitement, the impulse to make that purchase. And it even works for really important purchases, like my washing machine's broken. So not many families can do without a washing machine. If you've got kids about to go to school and they need their uniform cleaned, it's something that needs to be in place. but making sure that we can actually take a little bit of time to get the best deal, to get the most energy efficient machine and get the best machine for cost per use, which is comes out as one of the best cost per uses is washing machines and fridge freezers. That's what we're trying to help people with. And it's something I'm using myself, self-confessed shopper.
If only the Seagull family had actually gone for a washing machine as opposed to a PlayStation, it would have been a system. But Bobby, the notion of a post-it note being the ultimate buzzkill, I mean, is that one of the ways in which we can actually look at just putting, in a sense, barriers that we put in as self-checks so that we don't actually fall foul of overspending and suffering that regret of, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah. So I think we realize as humans, we have sort of desires and wants and needs. We need to make purchases. Some things are essential. Other things are like, oh, nice to haves. And if we can put little, again, not barriers, but almost like questions to ourselves. And again, the 2 days and 21 hours is like, oh, can I wait just under 3 days before purchasing it? Or can I maybe consult someone else? Or maybe can I, as Fiona talked about, can I do some research on comparative products? So just like having that little like pause with yourself rather than that immediate, ooh, you see this games console, ooh, let's get it now and let's regret it for the next year and a half. I think it's trying to help consumers feel less regretful about the things that they buy.
Fiona, in terms of Vanquis, the system's presumably in place that actually not only help improve your credit profile with Vanquis, but also it's a way of, again, paying attention to what we've been discussing this morning, actually making sure you don't necessarily go straight in and actually spend all of your credit limit right at the start.
Absolutely. And we encourage customers to spend carefully always. It's something that we're really keen on helping customers get onto a better path. And that path is putting more money in their pockets. So making sure they're not necessarily using up all their credit limits straight away, but using it for things they really need. And doing that with Bobby is really a dream for us, because it's getting to the heart of how we can support customers manage their money.
Well, of course, Bobby, with £105 million burning a hole in the West Ham finances pocket, presumably they'll also be keen to ensure that they spend wisely and don't suffer this buyer's remorse.
Again, with footballers, there's hopefully with the money that we spend, there'll be a good cost per use. The players that play many times, so we can reduce the average cost for that player.
We should use the calculation.
They should. I'll send
that
to the West Ham board.
Yeah.
They can also go to vanquis.co.uk to check out the cost per use calculator.
Well, that was something I felt needed to be addressed. And how can people, again, you've already mentioned it, Bobby, but Fiona, would you actually just give that web address one more time, please?
Absolutely. It's vanquis.co.uk. All the calculators are on there that Bobby has designed together with our research.
It's been fascinating sharing some thoughts with you, good selves, today. To Bobby Seagull, mathematician extraordinaire and general all-round fine individual. Huge thanks. And also to Fiona Henderson, Managing Director of Cards at Vanquis. Many thanks indeed. And happy shopping, both.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
Branigan, self-control. Yes, one needs one's self-control. Laura Branigan sadly passed away 2004. Do you remember self-control and Laura Branigan, Sarah Huntley?
No, I don't. Perhaps if I heard it again, I would.
I need my self-control. Da 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 da. She also had a big hit with Gloria.
I do. I certainly do. Yes.
And there's a big connection between, of course, Laura Branigan and self-control, and indeed, well, you could arguably say both of Richard's movie selections today, because one of them, if they showed a bit more self-control and restraint, it may have actually had a mild modicum of amusement. But nevertheless, Richard Fitzwilliams, what's the connection between Laura Branigan, self-control, and the late William Friedkin?
Well, he didn't have any self-control, I'm afraid.
Rubbish, Richard. William Friedkin directed the music video for Laura Branigan, which, of course, was self-control. And a man who actually brought to us the French Connection. He brought to us To Live and Die in L.A.
The French Connection, you're absolutely right. And indeed, he was a remarkable figure.
Orson Welles.
And may I quote to you at the end of this? Backs what I was saying. This is what he said in his memoir, The Friedkin Connection. I've been rude, exercised bad judgment, squandered most of the gifts God gave me. Do I have regrets? You bet. I mean, he was a remarkable man. And I mean, that chase scene in The French Connection's immortal. And the film was, of course, won Best Actor, an Oscar for Best Picture. Yes, I mean, that was very, very substantial as an achievement. He also did The Exorcist, which I thought was, rather childlike, frankly. I scared horror
movies. But it was about a child, Richard. It was about a child, projectile vomiting and head spinning round, played by, a whole range of wonderful things.
What did you think of it, Alex?
Not a movie I'd like to go and see, because primarily it features too much bodily functions, basically, Richard. So these are the key points. You know my feeling on that.
I know your feeling, but I still
projectile vomit is not good, whether it's Babylon or The Exorcist.
Well, I mean, firstly, I think Babylon was something one had to see. Secondly, but that was pretty...
At least there weren't any elephants crapping in The Exorcist, thank the Lord.
Well, yeah, that is probably something I couldn't challenge, but I would say that despite Max von Sydow, who always had a very powerful presence, I mean, it just left me cold. It was just the little...
Well, that's what happens when you have possession. You go cold. That's poltergeist activity. The temperature drops.
Are there any exorcists at the University of Lincoln, Alex?
Inevitably, they'll be there. I just don't like to talk about it.
Oh, but very sensible. No, with William Friedkin, I mean, I think he was a remarkable figure, but he wasn't necessarily someone who you would want directing you. Slapping actors and the like is a sort of behaviour that sounds pretty deplorable. And, of course, I think that with Francis Ford Coppola, with Spielberg and so forth, in, you know, recent decades...
It was New Hollywood.
His period was just the early 1970s, and that is a long time ago. But yes, he was undoubtedly an extraordinary figure. And with the, I love the story of the chase in the French Connection, which was completely illegal, ignoring all red lights. He was the Popeye Doyle was following the tram. What happens is that apparently he actually bribed someone $40,000 in a one-way ticket because he knew he'd be fired in the transit authority to film this. And it really was amazing no one was killed.
Sounds just like Graham Harper's work on his music videos, does it, Sarah Huntley? Nevertheless, obviously, I'll step away from that if Graham actually is listening. We know, Graham, you've never actually knowingly bribed anybody. You leave that to the BBC. Sarah, William Friedkin, were you a fan? Have you seen any of the epic movies that he's put together, such as indeed To Live and Die in L.A., even the CSI crime investigation series that he directed, or indeed Rules of Engagement?
Oh, well, I'm really sorry, boys. I haven't really seen any of those particularly. So I think you should just ask somebody else because I'm not going to be able to. There's a lot on my list I should start watching. I'm very sorry.
Okay, Sarah, in which case I'm going to put this to you. Would you like Richards to move to a movie which has received this particular line from Wendy Ide in The Observer? The inept criminal trope is taken to a new low in this dire caper in which a desperate couple abduct a politician, the kind of current kidnapping, a crime against comedy. Even the actual trailer is so full of F-bombs, we couldn't actually use it. Or would you prefer to actually go down the line of Paris Memories, a deep-feeling drama that takes place 3 months after a terrorist attack in which Mia is still traumatized and unable to recall that night? Where are you going to point, Richard? Paris Memories or indeed comedy that maybe isn't?
I know already. It has to be Paris Memories.
Well, there we are, Richard. Surprisingly, she's actually gone for Paris Memories as opposed to A Kind of Kidnapping, which I suspect, with your usual quirkiness, you'll probably rate it 9.5 out of 10.
Oh, no, I mean, Alex, that's an outrageous thing, especially since I've got now to review the film where, in fact, you've got that cheap jibe in when you've trapped me. Well, I'd certainly look at Paris Memories, and indeed, it's a film that's very, very sensitive, beautifully filmed, and structurally perhaps a little too neat, but it nonetheless, it examines trauma. It's a terrifying film in a way, because we meet Mia, who works as a translator at a radio station, played by Virginia Efra. In the early scenes, I mean, she behaves perfectly naturally, meets her partner, Vincent, played by Gregoire Colm, in a restaurant. He has an urgent call and has to leave, so she goes fatefully into a bistro. And this sort of mirrors the Bataclan attacks, where, I mean, it's terrifying. A terrorist walks into the bistro and massacres everyone that he can see. There are those who he doesn't find.
It's probably because he watched too many episodes of Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris.
I have to say, Alex, this is not a film about which you can joke. It is very, very powerful. Some survive, some don't. But what does survival actually mean? Because Mia Firstly, she can't remember. The entire experience initially is blanked off, and then we get flashbacks, and she starts recalling some of what's happened. And then, fatefully, of course, she breaks from her partner. She starts living. It's living in a moment that you can't remember, and it's terrifying. As she goes to survivors' meetings, and there she gets accused of locking the bathroom door, for example, to stop the terrorist getting in, but anyone else getting in. Did she actually do that? Who protected her, if anybody? She's starting to get an idea that it was a member of the kitchen staff. She's starting to get, as the film progresses, to get a feel for what happened, to feel the person breathing and so on. This is very powerfully done, and it's extremely well filmed. It's not only a study of trauma and what can come out of it. There are those who said that the film chooses an easy option, but because she has a relationship with Thomas, who's a fellow survivor, a fellow victim, played by Benoit McGimel, who I first saw, oddly enough, I think it was with Isabel Huppert in The Piano Teacher. That's a powerful film. Michael Haneke directs, if ever there was one. But there is also this feeling she has to discover, for her own, the sake of her own sanity, because everything revolves around what happened. She's unable to relate to Vincent anymore. She also has to find out the person who was with her or protected her or appears to have protected her, what happened to him, did he survive it, and so on. And she goes, the candles are lit, as tends to happen in after these atrocities. Paris plays a pivotal part in this movie, and in fact, it's absolutely, they're almost reassuring shots of a city that is famed for its beauty against the traumatic experience that someone's had, that a victim has over all this period of time. She meets a teenager who also survived, Felicia, played by Natasha Golubeva. And again, she returns time and time again to this bistro. It's become part of her, and she has this affair with Thomas. What happens to that? Does she find the person she's searching for? Only possible flaw in this movie, directed by Alice Winnicore, is the fact that structurally, as I say, it does pan out a little neatly, but it's a very powerful film, and Virginia Efira is absolutely superb, and indeed shots there's some remarkable scenes where all she does, you try and read her feelings, is where she just looks and behaves completely naturally. Remarkable actress, so I'm very, very impressed with this.
Just to point out, of course, that this is a fictional terrorist attack. Repeat, a fictional terrorist attack. Although filmmaker Alice Winnicore's brother was indeed inside the Bataclan concert hall in Paris in November 2015, when there was a massacre, and in which she actually was texted to by her brother, which is fine. It's a way of actually preparing for the Olympics, no doubt, which is pretty much what London did when they had riots around the capital and the country back in 2011, 2012. However, Sarah, as a Francophile, clearly this isn't Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, unless, of course, she's a terrorist. Would you like to actually check this particular one out in terms of Paris memories?
I definitely would. And I think the things that have really ticked my box, which Richard has just said, is the brilliant acting of this actress, almost simplified, but very intense without doing too much. It's all there. So I'd like to see that. I definitely, you've sold this to me, and I don't think I'd find it depressing. I think I'd just find it very, very.
Okay, Richard, 9 out of 10, I suspect, for yourself.
Yes, no, 9 out of 10. Very fine.
Well, obviously, you need to cleanse the palate after Paris Memories, and you need to obviously see a comedy. So would you actually choose to go and see the tale of a desperate, debt-ridden couple, a failing actor with impulse control issues, and an aspiring computer programmer who abducts an obnoxious Tory politician, not Boris Johnson, for ransom? What is it, basically, that leads to this whole genre of inept criminal comedy movies in which basic bodily functions and people shouting the word Dick, not in a kind of nice shortening of the word Richard, but in an aggressive way, is all about. Dick, sorry, Richard, would you like to share with us your thoughts on this? Who knows, yes, maybe you disagree.
I can do so pretty briefly because, funnily enough, I was going to quote the crime against comedy in the headline in The Guardian. I mean, this is just rubbish. A young broke couple kidnap a sleazy politician, bash him about, he puts out a plea because...
Do you start? How many sleazy... I mean, surely it's the whole 600-odd numbers of politicians there, really.
Well, I mean, one of the problems, I mean, there are a lot of problems with something that's as silly as this. The politician has been rude to her in a restaurant. They're both pretty hard up. You see Brian, played by Jack Parry-Jones, Maggie, played by Kelly Wenham, as she lost her job after that. Well, this is one form of revenge, but the politician sees this. Hardy, played by Patrick Bilardi, who sees this as a chance of actually getting onto the international map, because being kidnapped heightens his profile. Get it, get it, get it, even though his wife won't give any money. And even though director and writer Dan Clark has let himself down very, very badly with all this, it's so pointless and silly. But entirely apart from the fact that Hardy and Maggie start an affair, entirely apart from anything that happens with them and with the couple and so forth. And I mean, I'm tempted to give a spoiler at the end of it, quite frankly, because it's such a load of rubbish. But I will resist, of course, Alex. I'm sure you would not.
A classic such as this obviously deserves to be savoured. It's the kind of movie I'm sure that William Friedkin would have been proud to actually have on his resume. Or maybe not.
Just to give an idea, when it's known he's kidnapped, and the facts are that we see one of his aides talking about it on television. Who is concerned? He's not an MP who's well known, and he sees this, as I say, an opportunity of boosting his profile. The President of the United States has expressed concern. Well, no such thing would possibly happen.
Oh, I don't know.
And as a comedy, there are very, very few laughs in this. I can't remember laughing once. And black comedy, well, doesn't really deserve the sobriquet of anything other than an unfortunate choice of movie, of the cast haven't... Well, I mean, whether it's their fault or not, I mean, the material is
you can't blame the actors, Richard. They've got to work with the scripts they're given. I'm sure Sarah could share with us many tales of how she's actually dealing with something which ended up as the biggest turkey ever, but she had to lift it out of the page onto the stage.
Yes, a lot of new palm, I would say, left a lot of acting ability.
I wasn't even going to mention the company, Sarah. I was not even going to mention the company, but you've gone straight for it.
No. Not napalm. It was
Daphne and John would be bereft.
No, Daphne and John, it's not directed at you. They would agree. There were some lines, Mr. Tomlinson would agree, that were hilarious, which weren't meant to be.
At least you didn't swear I have bodily functions on stage, Sarah.
No swearing whatsoever. No, there was no F words or anything like that. No, not at Eastbourne. Goodness me, no.
Richard, is this a 2 out of 10 for yourself as far as the movie is concerned, or are you going to actually...
You're right, Alex. You've said it.
A kind of kidnapping, but not the kind of kidnapping that you would have had Joe Biden's son Hunter involved with, or indeed Donald Trump in terms of his own line. I mean, not that that could ever happen in the United States with the presidents being involved on that side of things. I mean, let's face it, it could be a scenario whereby Donald goes to jail, gets elected as president, and then pardons himself and releases himself from jail, which is quite exciting. Take that, Boris. Sarah, anything else you'd like to add from your base in Lincolnshire?
From my base in Lincolnshire, which I'll find out where I am. Well, I'd just like to say I agree entirely with your summing up of Donald Trump. Perhaps that actually would make quite a good film. I mean, a definite comedy, I feel. Yes, I don't think I'll be going to see that last film, because I think you both agree. And Natasha,
a kind
I wish
of kidnapping,
was
a kind of loving, easily confused.
Oh, well, a kind of loving.
Both
beautiful.
British movies.
Yes.
One in black and white, one in colour.
I'd first go and see the old black and white kind of loving, which is beautiful. So no, I definitely wouldn't. I wish Natasha was on to know that you've both agreed on a 2 out of 10, which I think is.
She's too stressed with the Matildas playing the lionesses. It's going to be problematic in all sorts of ways.
Oh, I see. I see. No, so I would definitely go and see the Paris memoirs, but not. I wouldn't waste my time on this other one. That I've taken your that. Yes.
And yet, the British film industry needs every penny it can get. You know, this could be the movie that could be the British Barbie.
Well, possibly yes, but Richard was saying to me recently that his cinemas are filling out a bit more, which is jolly
good news.
With
Barbie and Oppenheimer. And as we know, Jane Hill couldn't even actually understand what was being said in Oppenheimer. She had to leave halfway through because of the mumbling.
Who said who didn't?
Jane
who?
Hill, BBC correspondent.
No, but I
mean, out of Oppenheimer halfway through. Couldn't understand what was being said.
I didn't. Firstly, I'm very fond of Jane, and she's always taken an interest in films, and I mean, it was involved in the film programme when they had it with Mark Kermode, which sadly is no longer. It's extraordinary. I didn't notice. I noticed mumbling, and I didn't notice any in Oppenheimer. That's all I say. I think that there may have been a defective soundtrack, the particular film that a version she saw. It's distressing to hear that, of course.
Well, no more distressing than Christopher Nolan was distressed to find out a BBC newsreader had walked off halfway through because she couldn't actually hear what was being said. Anyway, that's by the by. Sarah, have you managed to see Barbie or Oppenheimer as yet, or is it a case of don't be crazy? I've been travelling around Europe.
I have actually been travelling around Europe, but I did go to the cinema on Thursday, and I just want to say there's nothing like going to the cinema and totally releasing your brain and focusing because you're out of the house on that film and living the moment. And that's why cinema has to carry on like it is. It's absolutely fantastic. And one of my favourite films, because I was in Sicily and I thought, oh yes, as I was walking around Cinema Paradiso, and you can just see those streets where he's talking to his mother and running out of the streets, if you know that film. But I just think there's nothing like it, and we should never, any of us, forget that. And sharing films with people, that's the other thing. I know we all like.
But and what actually, what did you see, Sarah? What did you hand over your hard-won pennies to go and see?
That's a bit of a top secret. You shall find out, Alex, because it's to come. You'll find out later. Yes, I think it's going to be what's the word? Talked about, but I won't disclose at the moment. I would like to see. I was going to just say, I think I mentioned it last week or the week before last, but and it's sadly it's closed now. But not film, but As You Like It, with at Stratford
with senior citizens.
With senior citizens. Was fantastic. And actually my friend who drummer in it was very sad on the last night, and he said, and he put a picture up saying, oh well, it's been a wonderful experience, and today would have actually been my mother's 100th birthday the night it ended. And so I put a comment on to say to him, well done. But I think what I love so much about that version of As You Like It was that the message was, age does not define you. It's who you are. And the message of As You Like It and Finding Love. And the cast were just amazing. I thought,
unless, of course, you're 87-year-old William Friedkin and now you're dead. So it defines him then. But there we are.
They actually made a joke about a lot of this cast were in the original cast of it, and that they were missing some of their members, but they would have been 107. And, you know, that's laughing at life. I think that was... So I think more productions done because of age, but I don't think it should be a barrier. And I think that's what that production of As You Like It said. And that was
one kind of ageism, a kind of kidnapping, a kind of, we could actually have a kind of film review. Richard, I mean, I was obviously Sarah's taking the spoiler approach even more than your good self, because in your own case, you just don't like giving spoilers around. Sarah doesn't even like giving us the name of the movie she's going to see, which is always very important. So that's another safe bet there. If you don't reveal that, it was probably Blue Beetle, but never mind. Richard, any thoughts on the latest upcoming fictional delight that we have optioned by the new dynamic and hyper-positive production team of Meghan and Harry and their latest romance novel, which they've taken on board? Have you not got hold of a copy as yet to actually say, yes, this is going to be the success of Harry and Meghan as the equivalent of Saltzman and Broccoli in terms of film producers?
Well, I mean, regarding this romance and the fact that the characters in it have certain links with their own lives also, I believe, it's apparently going to be funded by Netflix. Now, precisely where are Harry and Meghan and their careers at the moment? Harry, Japan and Singapore to raise money for Center Bali, which is his a charity to help HIV/AIDS sufferers in Lesotho. Then there's the Invictus Games in September, where they're going to Dusseldorf. Now, all of this, these two charities, very, very fine work. He, of course, did when he was a senior royal before he met Meghan. Where are their careers exactly? The answer to that is, despite her getting a new agent, Ari Emanuel,
no role for Meghan in A Kind of Kidnapping, and yet surely she was made for the female lead in that.
Well, all I can say is, so far as the adaptation of this novel is concerned, we're just going to have to wait and see where it goes. We knew that there was an animated series called Pearl, Netflix pulled, but they're going ahead. I mean, the point of all these rumours, they've lost Spotify, where her 12-part series Archetypes didn't go down well at all, but their Netflix contract, $100 million, is huge, doesn't expire till September 2025, I understand, so there's plenty more time for them. But how exactly are they going to use it? And are we seeing a move away from the endless and destructive knocking of the royal family? It's thought that that is the case. On the other hand, I mean, was it a four-book deal with Random House? And we had Spare earlier in the year. Could we have more memoirs or whatever?
Richard, as I said, you've got so many sequels. You've got Spare Tire, Spare Wheel. You know, there's so many ways you could actually deal with the whole Spare aspect there. It can go on ever on. It's like a Bond series.
Well, I just hope that the happier they are, both as a couple and professionally, the less trouble, in theory, the royals will get. It doesn't necessarily follow because they're unpredictable. And also, I mean, they wouldn't be trusted at the moment if they were considering returning, which is the last thing they're considering doing. There's so much speculation at the moment. All I say at the moment is that this new rom-com, it will be very interesting to see, or romantic novel, it will be interesting to see what they make of it in time. But apparently Netflix is funding it, and that being the case, because there were early reports that they might have been, obviously their contract with Netflix is still fine. So they'd only done one six-hour production. That was Harry and Meghan with all those texts and intimate photographs and all the rest of it last December. So
award-winning, Richard, I think. Award-winning.
I don't think it's won in the awards, has it, Alex?
Surely there should be a raspberry that actually goes along there. Sarah, I realise you can't actually comment on rumours that you are indeed in Lincolnshire scouting locations for Harry and Meghan's next abode in Britain, should they actually arrive, given that they'll be sort of East Midlands based. But any thoughts on this? Are you kind of hotly anticipating the latest insert into the Meghan and Harry epic?
Well, you know, you're just asking me this. Do you know what answer you're going to get back from me? I won't give them the time of day. I'm sorry. That's it. I can't. There's much more important things than them. And I'm not even prepared to comment on them because I just couldn't. I agree with Richard. If they were happier and got on with their lives, perhaps they wouldn't cause so much friction everywhere. I'm sorry, my final thoughts are there's so many people with real problems that I'm not prepared to engage in what they think their problems.
Well, we'll see what meet me at the lake, what they make of it. But yes, I agree. It's a sad business.
Well, there you are. Richard Fitzwilliams from the land of Sadiq Khan. A huge thanks as ever, as indeed I'm sure the Mayor of London will also give his thanks for another a classic example of how to really rip off motorists even more. Ule is coming around the corner, as it would be. But as a non-driver, Richard, you don't care. And why should you?
I didn't care. Alex, may I express deep, deep shock that you're quite correct. I'm a non-driver, but you're implying that I am not an altruistic person. Now, I put that to you. Is that not shameful?
But you don't do politics, so let's step away from that right now. Otherwise, we'd get into very hot water, even though you do appear on GMTV, or GBTV, I should say, on a regular basis.
Both of them, Alex. Both of them.
There you are. One for each hand. Sarah, thank you for your contributions today, as ever. In case people were wondering, Natasha had to go elsewhere. Likewise, Victoria Simmons was otherwise engaged in her French activities today. Kind of kidnapping, not given a thumbs up, surprisingly enough, from Richard. I know that'll resonate from that point of view, but maybe it's all down to William Friedkin and, of course, Paris Memories are all launching into play. That's been it for this particular sequence. To Sarah Huntley and to Richard Fitzwilliams, huge thanks. To everybody else, keep watching those movies.
I'm hearing the light from the window. I'm seeing the sound of the sea. My feet have come loose from their moorings. I'm feeling quite wonderfully free. And I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's only a whimsical notion to fly down to Rio tonight. But I probably won't fly down to Rio. There's wings to the thought behind fancy. There's wings to the thought behind play. And dancing to rhythms of laughter makes laughter the rhythm of rain. So I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. To fly.
have come to be solved. What I thought was proper for battle, I see now is proper for love. So I think I will travel to Rio, using the music of life. There's nothing that I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's only a whimsical notion to fly down to Rio tonight. But I probably won't fly down to Rio. But then again, I'll just fly.
Some years ago, up in the mountains that were white with snow, inside a cavern, MacDougall he was planning, there's gonna be a showdown with somebody he knows.
Well, he's been there a year or so, something will happen very soon, I know. I hear him playing his bagpipes every morning.
Tweedledum,